This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 5:07 and this is Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sharad, where we count down to the biggest story of the day.
Number 5.
Malaysian children are apparently not receiving adequate education, even though they spend more time in school than regional peers.
This comes as a report was released by the World Bank titled Bending Bamboo Shoots, Strengthening Foundation Skills. It revealed that 42% of Malaysians failed to achieve proficiency in reading by the end of Standard 5.
So that alone, I think, is kind of troubling, right? As is 42% is no small amount. But if you compare the statistic to other countries with similar gross national income, then it gets even worse because Malaysia's failure rate is higher in comparison to countries that are ostensibly of the same level as us. And the World Bank pointed out that this problem was particularly prominent among economically disadvantaged children, with 61% falling below proficient levels.
No, Lynn, you point a very important part of the story, which is that it's a comparative perspective, right? And it's comparing apples to apples and oranges to oranges as well. Okay, so the report also talked about Vietnam, which had about 18% of children fail to achieve proficiency in reading skills at the end of Standard 5. This is still lower than our average by a huge margin.
And the report also said that even though the average Malaysian child spends 12.5 years in school, so that's 12 and a half, it's actually only equivalent to 8.9 years of learning. So in other words, we're losing about 3 years, right? Despite the fact that we have that period of time in school.
And the gap between us and Vietnam on that score, again, more than a year difference, Vietnam having about 1 year more of education. So we reached out to Chan Sun Seng, CEO of Teach for Malaysia, for his response to this report.
The data coming out from the World Bank report is not surprising and is reflective of what we're seeing on the ground, especially in terms of foundational literacy and numeracy. Malaysia, as with many other countries in the world, has been significantly affected by COVID. So this 42% of students not being able to comprehend a simple text at Standard 5 is a significant increase from pre-pandemic levels, where it was only 13% of students who couldn't comprehend that text. So I think that a lot needs to be done, but we have to also recognize that pre-pandemic, there were huge gaps that did exist. And so when you think about a student that comes from a low socioeconomic background, these inequities did exist.
He also spoke about the importance of teachers in addressing the issue.
We definitely need to continue to ensure that our teachers are empowered to address these challenges. We need to continue to attract the most promising talent that we can into the profession. But once we've attracted them into the profession, we need to ensure that they are empowered and have the agency to actually address the challenges. So one of the big challenges in Malaysia is that teachers are bound by the grade level syllabus, meaning that if you're a kid in Standard 3, a teacher feels bound to deliver the Standard 3 syllabus. And we need to ensure that teachers feel the agency to meet students where they're at. So one of the recommendations in the report was to more effectively implement teaching at the right level, meaning that you could be a student who is in Standard 3, but if you are struggling with Standard 1 and Standard 2 content, we need to empower teachers to differentiate to meet the needs of those students, even if it goes beyond the grade level syllabus.
And finally, he talked about the government's efforts in combating learning loss.
One thing that I am encouraged by is the Prime Minister's announcement in the 2024 budget to allocate 100 million ringgit to address learning loss in Malaysia. And I think that that's a good start, but we are going to need to do a lot more beyond that.
That was Chan Sun Seng, CEO of Teach for Malaysia, talking about a new report from the World Bank that found that we are falling behind. Our children are falling behind, not receiving enough education in comparison to their peers in other countries. So 42% of Malaysian students are not achieving proficiency in reading at the end of Standard 5. And I think it's worth saying also that if you just think about how foundational a skill reading is, right, in terms of how it relates to the rest of your learning, I think then it's just so clear what the issue is. Because if you are not able to understand, I think Sun Seng used the word understand texts sufficiently. So if you're not able to understand what it is that you're trying to work on, then every subject is going to be a challenge.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, the other part of the report, which is to kind of take note of people coming from a disadvantaged position. I mean, I think sometimes, you know, we who come from families where there are books in the house and our parents read, we take for granted that this is a skill that's easily achieved, when in fact a lot of kids don't have that within their households in terms of their parents' capacities. And so, you know, those generational deficits get passed on, whereas generational privileges also get replicated, and then the divide between the two becomes ever more great.
If you have thoughts, that number to call is 7733-2900. Send a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Number four.
Continuing our countdown on Top 5 at 5, revisions for civil servants' pay.
Yesterday, the Prime Minister, Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim, announced that the revised Public Service Remuneration System, or SSPA, will be the best ever introduced. It's expected to have a significant financial impact, but no specific amount has been disclosed.
So there are a few things here, right? The update aims to improve the salaries of civil servants following a decade-long period of stagnation. The PM also says he is more cognizant of the welfare of civil servants as they are directly under the purview of the government.
So the plan to revise the system was announced last November and is set to be rolled out by the end of this year, that's 2024, and will be implemented fully next year, 2025.
Yeah, so details are still scarce. The promise is large, right? Any time someone says that this is going to be the best ever, the biggest ever, expectations are going to be ramped up. And I think in general, this one is interesting for a number of reasons. If you consider how large the civil service is in our country, then we can see, on the one hand, how many people's lives should be bettered by this, right? So that's one way of looking at it, that we are improving the lives and livelihoods of an important backbone of our country. Civil servants make things work. If we talk about public perception, though, of people who are not from the civil service and how they perceive issues of spending, particularly around, I think, salaries versus performance versus how we compare to something like the private sector, then I think the waters get a little murkier.
Yeah, this is interesting because even the fact of, you know, and I think this is often said by the chattering classes of a bloated civil service, isn't necessarily evidence-based. In some of it's prejudice, some of it's evidence, because there's also a question of who do you count as a civil servant, the police and the army counted in that number. Anyway, I think what seems to be recognized as the need to improve the civil service on many different levels, right? So I remember in January, there was this controversy about announcement about a recruitment via contracts being the mainstay for government when it comes to recruiting new people into the service. In fact, it was touted as a method to strengthen the public service remuneration system, as well as reducing the country's fiscal burden.
It is, I think, also important to say that this is not just a sort of general blanket revision without thought given to performance, because the Prime Minister did also emphasise that non-performing and lazy civil servants will not be rewarded under this revamped system, and that part of it aims to improve performance, right? So that, I think, is an important aspect when we're talking about something like this, because that is exactly where the conversation tends to kind of circle the drain, the idea of performance and KPIs and how do we know. So hopefully, once details are announced, we'll understand a bit better how exactly this is going to go. But if you have thoughts on reforms for civil servants' pay, you can call 7733-2900, send a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We will continue our countdown to the biggest story of the day on Top 5 at 5 after this, BFM 89.9.
Because freedom matters, BFM 89.9.
It's 5:18 and you're listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sherrod, where we count down to the biggest story of the day. So on story 5, it was about Malaysian students not learning enough, especially in comparison to our peers in other countries. Story 4, the revision to the civil servant pension scheme.
Number 3.
This is an interesting one. The US has officially pulled the plug on TikTok.
Right. So just before the President Biden signed off on this, the United States Senate approved legislation to ban social media platform unless it divests from its Chinese parent company, ByteDance. The company has been given 9 months to sell the platform.
So the legislation was largely a bipartisan effort, and both Republicans and Democrats claimed that TikTok was a threat to national security. Concerns were brought up over Beijing spying on Americans, manipulating public debate. I don't think we need to kind of rehash all of it. It's been really big in the news. I'm sure you would have seen a fair amount of kind of back and forth on this.
Yeah, so the recent Senate approval of, you know, money for Ukraine, for Israel, came along with this particular bit of legislation. Now, in response, ByteDance said it would rather shut down the app and sell it off if they have exhausted all legal options to fight the legislation. They added that although TikTok only brings in a small share of profits, the app's algorithms were key to ByteDance's overall operations. So a shutdown will have limited impact on the company as compared to completely giving up on the algorithm.
So I guess there are a few things to unpack. If TikTok really were sold to an American entity, or if it were to shut down its services in the US, would there be larger implications for freedom of speech? So for this, we asked basically this question to Dr. Benjamin Low, senior lecturer at the School of Media and Communication at Taylor's University.
To be honest, I think the global implications is going to be quite minimal. Essentially, the America always considers itself to be a bastion of freedom of speech. And here they are trying to sort of like force a foreign media outlet, sort of like social media platform, to sell itself under a pretense that, you know, it's not going to be mindful of its private data and whatnot. But a lot of the same provisions are still given to a lot of the other social media companies that are hosted directly in America. So there's a little bit of a very, very obvious sort of like bias there as well. And fundamentally speaking, the sale, if TikTok will very likely shut down rather than be sold to American-based companies, simply because even though America uses TikTok quite heavily, they still represent a very, very small percentage of its overall user base. So it doesn't really make sense for them to sell to a US-based company if they want to continue to operate there as well.
He echoed the fact that TikTok may not be severely impacted by the US decision.
To be honest, TikTok is probably still going to be one of the more popular social media platforms based on its use around the world. And it'll be interesting to see whether the US will sort of like shift their stance on this later on as well. Of course, this is not the first time a huge country has sort of like banned the use of TikTok. India has banned TikTok since 2020. And India, of course, is a much, very, very large market for it as well. And things seem to be going just fine for TikTok as it is.
That was Dr. Benjamin Low, senior lecturer at the School of Media and Communication at Taylor's University. And that is in relation to the US and TikTok and ByteDance. But we'd like to hear from you. I guess it's a thought experiment in some ways. What would happen if TikTok were banned, say, in Malaysia, right? Or was not available for us here anymore? How do you think it would change discourse? I mean, it's such a big place now for the spreading of news and ideas, some false, some not. So if you'd like to weigh in, you can call 7733-2900, send a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Number 2.
All right, almost at the top of our countdown, former Prime Minister Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad is in MACC's crosshairs.
Yeah, so the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission, or MACC, has confirmed that an investigation into Mahathir's two sons earlier this year is part of a broader probe into the former leader for corruption. Now, Moczani and Mirzan Mahathir were issued notices by MACC to declare their assets in Malaysia and abroad starting from 1981, which is the year Dr. Mahathir became Prime Minister.
So the agency also said that its probe is linked to the Panama Papers and the Pandora Papers. You may remember those leaked documents exposed numerous influential and affluent individuals worldwide who were concealing assets in offshore accounts to evade taxes.
Now, this marks the third prime minister, or the, rather, third former prime minister who has been investigated since Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim came to the helm of the country in the late 2022. The two others who are probed are Dato' Sri Ismail Sabri Yaakob and Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin.
Similarly, Malaysian courts have charged former finance minister and longtime associate of Dr. Mahathir, Tun Daim Zainuddin, as well as his wife, for failing to declare their assets, which has led some critics to suggest that Anwar is singling out adversaries and base adversaries, essentially.
Right. So we reached out to Pushpan Murugia, CEO of the Centre to Combat Corruption and Cronyism, otherwise known as C4, for comment.
C4's position is that any corruption, whether happened last year or 10 years ago, must be investigated if there is evidence and grounds to do so. It doesn't mean that all investigations are automatically politically driven. For us, the issue is structural. Unless the independence of the MACC is assured, any investigations will be criticized as selective prosecution. As an immediate measure to give confidence that Anwar is serious about fighting corruption, is to ensure the appointment of the next MACC chief go through a public chamber and not through his discretion. I believe the tenure of the current MACC chief is due to end in May. This could be his opportunity for him to show his commitment to reform MACC.
That was Pushpan Murugia, CEO of C4. If you have thoughts on this story, which is that MACC has confirmed that their investigation into two of Tun Dr. Mahathir's sons is actually part of a broader investigation into the former PM, that number to call, 7733 2900. Send us a voice note or WhatsApp, 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. So lots and lots of messages have already come in today, actually. Let's start with education, with Malaysian students basically not getting enough education in comparison to other students around the world. Abby says, the parents on the street do not need the World Bank report to tell us what the politicians are not. The elites need sheep to continue voting for them. The implementation of higher order thinking skills from Standard 1, where many still haven't even mastered the language, just encourage students to disengage from learning.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that not everything is a conspiracy by politicians. I mean, personally, I think that it could be a broader problem with the way in which we recruit into the system to become a teacher, the quality of that, and then the ongoing monitoring process by the ministry of, you know, what's happening at the school level. If you look at the report, I'm going to quote something from Malaysia Kini. It says, this is what is primarily there. It says the report attributed the poor learning outcomes to inadequate early childhood education, inconsistent teacher preparedness and dedication at the primary school level, and a lack of adherence to policy-guided teacher performance management. This is tough, you know. So, yeah, I don't think we need to reach immediately for the political conspiracy and, you know, to have an adequate sense of what's going on. Because in some sense, the politicians are going to go away. In fact, we're going to rely on the politicians to move the needle on reform that is obviously needed in the education system.
And on the subject of the pay scheme, the pension scheme revision for civil servants, Tash says, how do you discern lazy versus performing civil servants? I'm in a national agency where KPI means nothing. Everyone still receives a bonus regardless of performance. We don't reward high-performing employees because we want to avoid confrontation or conflict. I'm for wage reviews, but it must be based on merit and performance. Guidelines must be clear. And in terms of civil servants, especially the ones that engage with the public, we should have a say in how they engage with us. We should get to vote or give feedback or review, and this must be taken seriously with transparency.
Now, Tash, that's very interesting, because obviously you can't sort of tag on or sort of, you know, the kind of performance mechanisms that we have in the private sector onto the government. Because there isn't, I guess, the question of the profit motive, and there isn't these kinds of things. But there are things that maybe the public sector can learn from the private sector, right, in terms of how to measure
incentivize performance. Not just measure, incentivize.
Yeah, and then the question is, how do you do it, and how do you do it in a way that's fair, and how do you do it in a way that doesn't create conflict? I mean, I don't think not wanting to conflict is necessarily a bad objective. It can't be the sole objective, because at some point you need to pull people up. And it seems like the message coming from Putrajaya is that it's willing to do that.
I think the public-facing perspective is also important, partly because that speaks to incentivizing better service. And I think for a lot of people, and in general for the government, right, those kinds of positions are typically where most people, most Malaysians, will actually run up against the civil service. Otherwise, they're just sort of this amorphous thing that we know is the engine, but we don't see them unless we are at counters facing people. You know, and so I think some element there of incentivizing good service, good treatment is not necessarily a bad thing, as per Tasha's suggestion. Meanwhile, Lam on TikTok says, the US decision is absolutely rubbish. More double standards and hypocrisy, plain and simple. It's an economic cold war, tough on the users.
Yeah, but Lam, you know, what we can rely on is that TikTok is going to fight this all the way in the courts in America.
And apparently it's not going to make that much of a dent for them, even if they were to exit the US market.
Yeah, not. And in fact, for the users, which is, I think, something that CEO of TikTok is constantly signaling, you know, they have 170 million users and they want to be fair to them.
Yeah.
There are so many ways to bypass any attempted banning it. And in fact, some of the analysts say it's many years before you see an absolute ban on TikTok.
Sabrina simply says, I would be happy if TikTok was banned. My teenage daughters would have more time to study. So there you go. Keep those thoughts coming. You can call, send us a voice note or WhatsApp, as well as tweet us at BFM Radio.
Because freedom matters. BFM 89.9.
It is 5:37, and you're listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sherrod, where we count down to the top 5 stories of the day. We are just about there, actually. But before that, just a quick look through some of the messages that have come still on the stories that have kind of come along earlier. So if we start off with education, because Malaysian students are just simply not getting as much education as their peers in other countries that have the same economic status as us, broadly speaking. And we have thoughts on this. So SRA says, there are several factors that hamper our education. A bureaucratic mindset that refuses to acknowledge real problems on the ground. Problems are often concealed to the higher-ups in order to save face. And teachers are overburdened with non-teaching jobs, accompanying students to events, organizing events, filling in endless forms.
Yeah, SRA, this is an interesting thing about the overburdened teacher. It's been a problem that's been signaled for some time now. The demands for calls for, you know, assistance for those kind of non-teaching aspects of the job. I think that's been there for some time now. And certainly, you know, not being able to inform the higher-ups, I think, is a big issue. But what our guests earlier, you know, from Teach for Malaysia did signal is that the government's commitment to address very specifically learning loss, 100 million ringgit into that kitty to deal with not just with COVID, but I think with the larger problem of learning loss.
So Anon, meanwhile, says, I would like to highlight that the Breakfast Grill's guest speaker this morning from the World Bank also praised Malaysia's existing education blueprint, but it was mentioned that it's under review. I strongly hope that the current people at the helm of the MOE don't make changes for the sake of change or to leave their mark for being in office. After all, the issue of our young ones' poor basic reading and writing skills seems to be the doing away of reading, spelling and even storytelling subjects in the current syllabus. Most of my colleagues, 50 years and younger, have oral and written communication skills, which often leave them dumb and feeling inferior when in public gatherings.
Yeah, no, this is very interesting because it does seem like, you know, we're often very good at establishing these or, you know, creating these blueprints, right? So, and then it is, there are checkpoints to figure out whether we're actually delivering on it. But, you know, I guess it's the whole ecosystem, right? Because it doesn't matter if the policymaker has it all right on a design level. The question is implementation, and then you have all the problems. And I think what Chan Chun Seng from Teach for Malaysia kind of pointed out is not only do you need to recruit good people, but once they're in the system, they have to be empowered and rather than sort of ground down by the existing culture. And how do you manage that, I think, balance?
Lewis says, it's funny, and this is on the subject of TikTok. If China can ban Facebook and YouTube, then why can't the US ban TikTok?
I guess, Lewis, you know, all countries are free to do what they want.
Yeah.
I mean, all governments can do it. But then the issue would be, should China have banned Facebook, or if they did, I can't remember exactly the details around that. But I mean, China is not known for its liberal regime. I was just reading something about how China's coming down on, China's censors are coming down on what they call micro dramas. So, but the question is, at the end of the day, what kind of world do we want to live in? Do we want to validate what's being done in the US just because other administrations do equally bad things?
Keep those thoughts coming. After this, we're going to head to the biggest story of the day on our countdown to that on Top 5 at 5. We'll be back, BFM 89.9.
Because freedom matters. BFM 89.9.
It is 5:43 and you're listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sharad, where we count down to the biggest story of the day. To recap so far, story 5, Malaysian students not learning enough, especially in comparison to our peers. Story 4, about revisions to civil servants' pay. Story 3, the US Senate officially kind of pulling the plug on TikTok. Story 2, MACC probing Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad.
Number 1.
Which brings us to the biggest story. Will Sabah's 40% special grant see the light of day?
Yeah, so this is really part of a very interesting dynamic that's been set up in the last couple of years about, you know, the territories of Sabah and Sarawak in terms of the relationship to the federal government. Federalism is something that I think is not fully conscious in a lot of it, especially us living in Peninsula, and especially us living in the Klang Valley. I think that is something that gets played out more and more intensely, and this is why this story is actually quite interesting.
So joining us to talk about this, we have Arif Adi Putra Anwar, Research Associate at the Institute for Development Studies Sabah. Arif, thank you so much for joining us.
Good evening.
So in a recent report, some observers note that Sabah's elected reps, including those from the opposition, may lose popular support if they fail to effectively advocate for Sabah's entitlements. Is this a strong sentiment among the Sabahan community?
Definitely, because leaders who have rode on the rhetoric of Sabah's entitlements would always be held up to those promises. And hedging tactics such as this will always be held accountable by voters who supported their leaders on this narrative. But its efficacy cannot be understated, as the tone has always been emotionally charging and it's underwritten by principles of equality and social justice, where one leader that may not be able to maintain this kind of momentum, another may step up to champion the cause. As we have seen with the failure of Barisan Nasional to adequately articulate them, it was later supplanted by the Warisan government and now has been transplanted to the GRS government, who has become its most vocal proponents. But because of this, the backlash that it could potentially face is even greater.
Now, help us, for those of us who don't understand or aren't aware, what is the significance of Sabah's demand for 40% of the federal government's annual net revenue? And how does that relate to the Malaysia Agreement of 1963?
Well, in the preliminary documents leading up to the formation of the Federation, the Intergovernmental Committee Report, or the IGC, stands as the primary source for the arrangement of the Federation, which was then put into the Malaysian Agreement and hence the Federal Constitution. So the Intergovernmental Committee report contained the 40%, or what they called at the time the two-fifth revenue sharing, under paragraphs 24, section 6, section 8 and section 9, which was then placed into Article 112C and Article 112D of the Federal Constitution. Therefore, there's a whole historic development on how the 40% was an important prerequisite for Sabahan leaders, that it almost straddles close to the line of sanctitude as it forms the core foundation of Sabah and the Federation. To some, it is a matter held very sacred. So where it came from? It came from the preliminary ideas of how is it that the Federation will be set up? How will it incorporate Sabah and Sarawak? And this report was the rock bed for the 40% itself. And because it is placed into the Federal Constitution, it is a very, very important agreement that still being argued hasn't been upheld.
Yeah, so why hasn't it been? I mean, what's fallen by the wayside? Is it the political elite that's forgotten it? Is the population forgotten it? Federal forgotten it?
I think there's a multiple combination of factors here. One of it, which I think can attribute, is governmental stability as a causal factor. These negotiations aren't exactly new and have been ongoing since the tenureship of Datuk Seri Najib Razak. Back then, it was Tan Sri Hanifah Aman and Datuk Najib Shukri from Sabah and Sarawak who co-chaired the second National Steering Committee meeting on the devolution of powers to Sabah and Sarawak. That was way back in 2018. But with the changing of government in such a wild and ragged fashion in the past 4 to 5 years, it has made it very difficult to regroup a narrative under different types of leadership, so different understandings and priorities on the matter. So the priorities for these kinds of devolution and decentralization from past governments such as Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin to Ismail Sabri and currently Sri Anwar Ibrahim, they may have different priorities or even understandings of how these negotiations actually carry, what is the weightage that they carry. So hence, they always have different ideas of how they would like to tackle this issue, but it's never been consolidated properly.
So if we talk about the specific negotiations for the special allocations, which have gone on for almost a year now, in this particular process, what are the main challenges that have emerged?
I think the challenge mostly comes to what exactly does this 40% revenue entail, because the exact number for how much is collected from Sabah isn't properly, reported to the state government. But in the last year, Sabah did gain a seat through a parliamentary bill, which allowed a Sabahan representative to sit on the Inland Board Revenue of Malaysia. Therefore, we already see a Sabahan representative that is able to understand the bigger picture only now. And because only now we are able to access that kind of data, only now that a formula can be developed. So it's also a part of, we don't exactly know how much is being owed to the Sabah state government. And this is also, I would say, being made even more complicated by arguments propping up saying that the federal government should be held accountable for what is called the lost years of that revenue sharing, that Sabah is entitled 2 years that hasn't received the 40% revenue. It should be sent as a form of reparation or compensation for the state government.
Now, why hasn't Sabah been able to leverage its political clout to the extent it has, as Sarawak is doing? I mean, to secure this special allocation, are Sabahans looking to Sarawak as a model to deal with Putrajaya?
I don't think the narrative fits one-to-one between Sabah and Sarawak. Firstly, Sarawak doesn't have a 40% revenue sharing as Sabah does. What they can claim is the special grant, however, which, compared to the 40%, is a smaller financial commitment for the federal government to uphold. Secondly, Sarawakian leaders possess a collective understanding on its needs and aspirations much better than Sabahans, and they are much better organized because of that. So because they are better organized, they are able to negotiate with the federal government as a united front. And this can be attributed to an embedded state identity, and with Sarawak possessing 150 years of continuity since the White Raja era of the Brooke dynasty, whereas Sabah has only existed as a polity for the past 60 years, statehood within the Sarawakian consciousness is properly entrenched, while Sabah is still meandering and pondering on what exactly is its identity. And without that kind of identity, it doesn't give Sabah a strong foundation to challenge the federal government in the way that Sarawak does.
Could you also explain the stance of the federal government on the special grants and how the federal's 300 million ringgit interim grant has been perceived?
Well, most considerations for Sabah and Sarawak has historically been underpinned by political mileage, and this government is no different. It is a strategy used to placate regional leaders, which can serve almost like bread and circuses for the people, and stymie resentment until concrete promises are delivered. Now, because of this, there is some suspicious cynicism that this is only pittance to Sabah and Sarawak, and that among several leaders, there is a debate as to who should really be credited for this push, as the return of this initiative, you could argue, began during Najib Razak's premiership and gained momentum during Dato' Sri Ismail Sabri's time as Prime Minister, where actually talks about the special grant was brought up during his time. Back then, it was about 125 million that he proposed, and it was only until this government that was reviewed to 300 million. So the issue here is, if that is given, who should it be credited to? How does it translate into political support? And a lot of leaders will try to use this to further their own legitimacy as the, champions of the Sabahan aspirations.
Now, Arif, if this resolution of this issue is delayed, how will this impact Sabah's own development initiatives?
Well, Sabah has always operated under its own constraints, and not many plans have been made as of yet should the 40% revenue be received to the state government, as the determined amount hasn't been fully quantified first, which is where Sabah in recent years have begun to explore other revenue sources to meet the demands of development. This could be through foreign investment with foreign companies and other schemes for revenue generation, such as the Nature Conservation Agreement. So Sabah has always been aware that this 40% is quite a huge undertaking. It may not be fully materialized in the next even 4 to 5 years. So not many considerations was made with that in mind as a safeguard to ensuring that the people don't feel that they are shortchanged in this regard.
Let's also talk about data, because reports suggest that Sabah's repeated requests for data to determine the allocation have been met with silence. What do you understand is happening here?
Well, like I mentioned, we never had a board on the Indian Board Revenue or LHDN. So we don't have a full idea of how much it should be given back to Sabah. Now, right now, there is a circulation of a proper formula, a formula that is no doubt being worked on right now, being presented at the MA63 Technical Committee. So right now, it is mostly a back and forth process on a G2G basis that's being revised and negotiated. And because of that, it will take some time. But however, the state government did say that they have several months for the federal government to come to an agreement on the formula itself by whatever assessor that they deem adequate for this task. But the silver lining to this is that there are supporting initiatives such as the Sabah Law Society, which is undertaking a judicial review against the federal government. However, on the other side of the coin here, a cynical probability for the delay on the federal government's part is to continue dangling the proverbial carrot on a stick to secure Sabah support. Not to mention other arguments such as the loss here is making things a bit more complicated. So there's a lot of things being tossed back and forth, which hasn't fully been materialized or even, how you say, strategized at the higher level, because this is on a G2G basis. It is not exactly public knowledge.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but if Sabah decides to go for a phase-by-phase approach to the negotiations, how will this impact the demands that Sabah is able to make? I mean, considering that they're going to have to move ahead with incomplete data.
Well, it depends on the flexibility of both the Sabah state and the federal government. There is no textbook way to undertake these negotiations, and both sides are still experimenting in this respect. In a way, this is still an experiment of state building and re-establishing the configuration of the federation. But it needs to be said that this is also an experiment of federalism. So I would foresee that alongside the pursuit of this 40% and the upholding of the special grant, there will be newer concessions being brought to the table, which will no doubt provide deviation to current plans, that there's not exactly a roadmap to how these negotiations will take place. However, there's other bits and pieces of decentralization or devolution that Sabah can take back as, how do you say, like a side objective to the main narrative itself. For example, the Continental Shelf Act is still being pursued in tandem with the 40% as well. So we could see inroads in particular aspects of devolution and autonomy, where we might see some progress or even less progress or stagnation in things such as the 40%, because it is quite a big undertaking in itself.
So a lot of our conversation today has been somewhat about this idea of a narrative, about an understanding, and how might the handling of these demands end up affecting the Sabahan community's perceptions towards Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim's leadership in the Madani government as a whole?
Firstly, the Sabahan community, we look towards our leaders first, the Sabah state leaders first, before looking into the wider narrative of the federal government. So it would definitely grant more prestige to the state government, who, if honour dictates, will cement the GRS government's support to Prime Minister Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim. But this is in the case of a critical success of these negotiations. In the event of a mild success in the fulfilment of these demands, support may remain conditional on the political stability of the unity government. The Prime Minister has made several attempts to increase support in Sabah through granting of immediate funds or relief funds to resolve ad hoc issues such as the water issue at University of Malaysia Sabah about a few months ago. But without the wide sweeping infrastructural provisions, then it would be difficult for him to emulate Dato' Sri Najib Razak's popularity, which held a lot of latitude within Sabah for quite some time, even after his loss in the general election in 2018. So in that respect, the Prime Minister, when he comes down to Sabah, he would need to make a conscious effort to mention that all of these provisions or all these granting of, benefits to Sabah has to be held under a narrative which MA63 fits the bill. However, since the Prime Minister has returned, he has been giving projects or provisions on an ad hoc basis. There's no core central theme or narrative that's able to bind all these things together for people to connect the dots and say that, hey, this prime minister is actually committed to Sabah's aspirations and autonomy.
Aris, you have any final thoughts for us here in Malaya?
I think in doing what we ought, we deserve no praise because it's our duty. And in this matter, is one something of statesmanship and not self-aggrandizement. It is easy to fall to the trappings of heroics that we draw from our founding fathers here in Sabah. But even then, when they were still in power, it was a matter that was too large even for them. The federal government still looms almost in a very supreme kind of fashion over the ongoings of Sabah. That has been the case since the founding of the Federation. So there's definitely a huge power imbalance that's still persistent even today. And for that correction of that power imbalance requires both the state government and the federal government to play in good faith with one another, to negotiate with one another, and understand that Sabah and Sarawak chose to join the form the Federation on a conditional basis. And that basis is also held in the ideas of federalism, which can be, let's say, a 1+2 kind of arrangement. And as such, Sabah and Sarawak should be held in a higher regard than most people would assume.
Arif, thank you so much for speaking with us. That was Arif Adiputra Anwar, Research Associate at the Institute for Development Studies in Sabah, talking about the issue of that 40% special grant for Sabah and, you know, how we're seeing that develop. Keep it here, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.